introduction to what I'm going to talk about. And I'd also call your attention to the wonderful display in the back of the room called National Register Sites and Technology. Can you all see the screen? Please feel free to move around a bit. Go to your slide and you can check it out. When I was in school studying architectural history, I was pretty much taught to look at a building as a work of art unto itself. And kind of study the major monuments of the history of architecture. No interest whatsoever, really, for the community surrounding these buildings. And so sort of a building as museum piece approach. To give you an example, this is a cathedral in France designed by the noted French modern architect Le Corbusier, that dates from the 1950s. What I'm going to be talking about today is a much different approach, a much broader approach. This simple gabled roof frame house would go unnoticed by just about anyone who walked by, because after all, there are hundreds like it across the state. And yet, when you find out that this particular house, standing on the street in the residential area of Sandstone, Minnesota, is one of the best preserved examples of scores of houses built by the Minnesota Fire Relief Commission after the disastrous Hinkley Fire destroyed a large part of Minnesota's forest, it becomes much more interesting. The Fire Relief Commission built about 150 of these houses for the victims of the fire. So by knowing a little bit more about the history of Minnesota, a really plain little building like this gains some significance. The State Historic Preservation Office of the Minnesota Historical Society has been identifying and evaluating properties for listing on the National Register of Historic Places since 1969. And many of the first properties that were listed were of readily apparent significance, such as prominent American architect Louis Sullivan's National Farmers Bank at Owatonna, or the various early 19th century buildings at Fort Snelling. Then beginning in 1977, the Preservation Office launched a systematic county-by-county historic building survey. Properties identified during this survey were evaluated with respect to what they could convey about the history of the county where they were located. And I think the slideshow you saw earlier is a good example of that kind of approach. So the focus shifted from finding the oldest or the first or the best or the most unique to finding properties that represent broad themes of history. So this church is of interest. This Lutheran church, you saw it in the earlier slideshow, and I'll show you several of the county buildings in that room. Why is it important? Because it was associated with an especially important ethnic group, the Swedes, who settled in the Richmond area. For a transit depot, this is the Waldorf Depot of 1908 in the southwestern Osage County, important as part of the town's development. Farmhouse, the Phelps Farmhouse in St. Mary Township, Washington County, built in 1869, probably would have been listed on the National Register 10 years ago, based simply on its architecture, because it's a terrific example of the Italian style of architecture. But then you dig a little bit further, and in this case, I think quite a few of the Waseca County nominations were done by the Historical Society here. And they found out that the builder and owner of the house was very involved in land speculation. He contracted with the railroad to move freight and distributed railroad ties along the road as the tracks were being laid, and supplied the railroad with wood for fuel. Now, as the Preservation Office is completing its survey of the whole state, I think they have completed over two-thirds of the counties, they've begun developing a new approach to looking at buildings. And this is called, there's a lot of jargon here, so bear with me, comprehensive historic preservation planning. And if you take a look at the handout that I passed out earlier, you'll see that they've we and they have devised some historic context, so to speak, for evaluating historic buildings. They're also working on a lot of contexts which deal primarily with sites of archaeological significance. Almost all buildings I'll be showing you this afternoon are either listed on the National Register of Historic Places, or they are in the process of being listed, or the number objected to designation, but they were determined to be eligible for listing anyway. I'm going to give you a brief look at the seven, we have time, historic context shown on the map, and some of the buildings that are associated with each one. First is reservations of an Indian community. And this is at Pipestone Quarry, Pipestone County. And I put a county map on the back of that handout just so you can kind of follow me if you aren't sure where I'm referring to. From the time of the first permanent white settlement at Fort Snelling in 1819, Indians were under pressure from traders and land-hungry settlers. The 1825 treaty signed at Prairie du Chien roughly separated Minnesota's two major Indian tribes into Ojibwe territory in the north and Dakota in the south. The Indians relinquished most of their lands to white settlers in a series of treaties, and a lot of the Ojibwe ended up on reservations in the northern part of the state, and the Sioux ended up in about six different communities in southern Minnesota. And needless to say, the move to the reservations really disturbed their traditional lifestyle. We found that quite a few of the sites that have been listed on the National Register in Minnesota over the years that pertain to Indians reflect white settlers' efforts to get the Indians to conform to the dominant white culture. And I think that that's going to change a little bit as this whole process helps us re-establish our priorities for future survey work. Of course, many of the sites that relate to Indians and don't relate to whites were built with fairly temporary building materials, and probably a lot of them are archaeological sites rather than standard buildings. Indians have quarried the stone at Pipestone for centuries, using it for pipes and other artifacts important for practical and ceremonial purposes. And although they eventually agreed, this became a reservation in the 1850s and was eventually sold back to the federal government, that Indians were granted perpetual use of the quarries. This is the Gideon Pond House in Bloomington, in Hennepin County, dating from the 1850s. Reverend Gideon Pond and his brother, a teacher, came to Minnesota in 1834, and their home became a center for our mission, and also they did one of the first alphabets, the Pond alphabet of the Dakota language, and published a spelling book, grammar, and dictionary. A lot of the buildings of this 1850s period are very plain, simple proportions. It's the Upper Sioux Agency in Yellow Medicine County, built in 1860. This was actually a duplex for one of the employees of the Indian Agency. And here the federal government tried to, quote, civilize the Indians, and their efforts, of course, failed and led to the Dakota War of 1862, formerly known or still known by some people as the Sioux Uprising. Fort Ridgely in Nicollet County was built after the 1851 Treaty of Traverse to Sioux to protect white settlers in the area to watch over the Dakota. It was the site of two battles in the Dakota War, and the fort was then garrisoned until 1867. It was excavated and the commissary building was restored during the 30s as part of one of the Roosevelt Depression Relief programs. A typical early mission churches in Minnesota is this St. Joseph and Mary Church in the Pond du Lac Indian community in Carlton County. It's from 1884, a very plain, dovetailed log structure. It looks today, the earlier photo was from the 1940s. Bishop Henry Whipple established a mission at the Lower Sioux Agency in 1884. 1960. It pretty much closed down after the war. And then in 1891, they rebuilt this little mission church on land donated by one of the Indians who was a member of the congregation. And Bishop Whipple built all kinds of Gothic revival-style churches throughout Minnesota in the late 19th century. The federal government decided in 1887, with the passage of the Dawes-Farrelty Act, that what they should do is, rather than trying to isolate the Indians on the reservations, they should get them to go along with the mainstream white culture. And in order to do this, first of all, they contracted with a number of church groups to build schools on the reservations. This is St. Benedict's Mission School in White Earth, Becker County, in 1892. And it was mainly a school for Ojibwe girls, a lot of them orphans, and they were taught domestic skills as well as academic subjects. The school remained in operation until 1969. Another approach was adopted in the 1890s. That was when the government decided, well, these church schools just really aren't working. Let's build some U.S. government schools for the Indians. This is the Lawrence Industrial School for Indians in Stevens County. It got its start as a Catholic boarding school that was taken over by the federal government in 1896. And there were quite a few buildings there. It remained in operation until 1909. This was one of the dormitories. It was then transferred to the state government. I guess they decided that this approach really wasn't working too well either. It became the West Central School of Agriculture, and in 1960 became the University of Minnesota at Morris. We'll take a look at the map briefly. There are some of the students. Now I'm going to move on to a brief look at the St. Croix Triangle lumbering era, which spans from the 1830s to the early 1900s. And as you might expect, white pine was the key to the development of the lumbering industry. And logs were cut during the winter and transferred down to St. Croix around the Mississippi rivers in the spring to the boom sites. The logs were then taken from there to the sawmills, and the sawmill sites, several of them became centers of town site development. Anoka, Taylor Falls, Stillwater all got their start as lumbering sawmill sites. This is the St. Croix boom site north of Stillwater. It was established in 1856, and logs were collected here. It was one of the biggest boom sites. At its peak, the logs would extend back up the river for 9 miles. And here they were sorted and marked and so forth, and then tied into big rafts and shipped down the river to the sawmills. This boom company remained in operation until 1914. Stillwater was the leading lumber center on the St. Croix. This was the town's second lumber mill. The stone part on the right dates from 1850. And here's a turn of the century photo of the same operation. The portion you see to the left was added around 1900 and was used. I guess the lumber mill there remained in operation until the 1890s, and it began to be used as a door and a sash factory. It's now an antique complex of some sort. If one architectural style could be said to correspond to the St. Croix lumbering context, it would have to be the Greek Revival style. This is in the Angels Hill Historic District in Taylor's Falls, and this house was made from the 1850s. Many of the lumbermen of the era of this period came from New England, and you could probably argue that they designed their houses based on what they had left home behind them. And all the houses in this Angels Hill area above Taylor's Falls are all wood frame, of course. If you were a lumberman, you couldn't build a brick house. and most of them made from the 50s and 60s. Founded in 1839, Green on St. Croix was the site of one of the first lumber mills in the state. And however, the town didn't really grow very rapidly until 1850, when it became the site of the state's first Swedish settlement. And the Swedes provided the labor for the local lumber industry. The lumber industry flourished here only until the early 80s, when log jams on the St. Croix made it impossible to fill lumber contracts. And the building in the center of the street there was the general store and office for one of the major lumber industries. This is a barn in Maverick County dating from 1880. In the northern portion of this St. Croix area, there were a number of farmsteads operated by major logging concerns. This was a headquarters and storage facility for Isaac Staples Logging Company, and they summered the oxen here and cultivated feed and food for the winter logging season. Weyerhaeuser owned this for many years, and they continued to function as a logging farm, complete with bunk house and post office and so forth, until about 1900 when the logs in the area were depleted. Among the groups that settled in the region and developed the cover lands for agriculture, the Swedish immigrants were especially prominent. Ashanti County came to have one of the highest concentrations of Swedish settlement in the United States. Rural churches such as the Swedish Mission Church of South Maple Ridge became focal points for the rural community. This building dates from 1897, a very plain church, and it still has a little Gothic touch with those pointed arches over the windows. Moving on to early agriculture and river settlement on the map there. Southeastern Minnesota, as you know, was the setting for the early development of one of Minnesota's prime industries, agriculture. And settlement occurred largely along waterways, the Minnesota and Mississippi rivers and their tributary areas. Agriculture in this period, running through about the 1870s, was primarily subsistence level farming, although farmers began growing wheat as a cash crop. This is the Stouffville farm. It's just outside of Rochester, at least from about 1860. Interesting because it's a stone farmhouse, which is fairly unusual, but the scale of the farmhouse and farm is fairly typical in this early period. A lot of the towns that were developed in this area were developed by speculators, town site companies, and groups with a particular ethnic focus. And the towns often focused on rivers, both as a source of transportation and water power. And many of the towns, of course, became centers for agricultural product processing facilities, such as flour and sorghum mills and breweries, typically small operations that catered to a local market. This plain wood frame rural church in Blue Earth County, Stoney Township, was built in 1867 by a congregation that included members of the Minnesota Settlement Association, a group of 139 families from New York City, many of them of Scottish descent, who arrived in 1856 to study this portion of Blue Earth County. Here again, very plain architecture, almost severe. This water-powered limestone flour mill on Big Trout Creek in Monona County, built in 1856, is the oldest still standing in Minnesota. Facilities such as this served an important role in the local economy as farmers depended on wheat as their main cash income. Many of the smaller mills were eventually absorbed into larger consolidated corporations such as Pillsbury and Washburn and Crosby. Alexander Faribault was the founder of the city that now bears his name. His home near the Straight River was the first frame residence in Rice County. And like many of the early pioneer homesteads, the structure served not only as his home, but also as a community center, church, polling place, meeting area, you name it. Planted in the 1850s, St. Peter became a thriving river town when a group of prominent citizens formed a company and built its fine hotel to accommodate travelers. Like many of the more ornate commercial buildings constructed in river towns in the 1870s, it employs the Italian style of architecture, with the paired brackets up at the top of the cornice and the tall narrow window openings and the tall narrow proportions. Here they wanted to build such a great building, they brought in a big name architect from St. Paul by the name of Edward P. Basford. The building was completed in 1873. Vanderbilt in Dodge County was established in the 1850s along the Zumbro River by a trio of Pennsylvanians who hoped to take advantage of the area's fertile soil, river accessibility, and abundant building stone. And in 1871, they brought in a Milwaukee architect to design their courthouse, a quite an imposing stone structure. The population of the community has remained under 500 since the courthouse was built, and it's the oldest courthouse in Minnesota that is still used for its original purpose. In 1859, A.R. Morrell, a Vermont ironsmith, built this stone ironworks on the banks of the Mississippi River in Hastings, and it's one of Minnesota's earliest known industrial structures. Originally an ironworks, it became a steamboat works, and later an engine works for the grain elevators along the Hastings and Dakota Railroad in the 1870s. Another example of a fairly plain architecture of this era, this is the Jefferson Steamboat Warehouse in Jefferson Township, Houston County. And it was built in 1868 along a navigable slough of the Mississippi River. And they stored grain here until it was transported out by steamer. Just a few years after it was built, a railroad line was built along the Mississippi, making the building fully obsolete for its original purpose. And today it's all the remains of this once, I don't know if you could say thriving, but there was a town there at one time. A lot of the industrial and warehouse and buildings of this 1850s to 1870s period are fairly plain. These being constructed of stone quarried from probably very near the building site. Moving along to railroad construction and agricultural development, which encompasses a lot of the history of Mohican County and runs from the 1870s through the 1920s. If you take a look at the map, you can see that this covers a huge portion of the state. And it was a region, and is a region of large-scale agriculture characterized by a common system of production, transportation, and processing of agricultural products. Primary features in the development were the network of railroads, and the production first of wheat and later of a variety of farm products from more diversified farming operations. The typical production unit was, of course, a family farm. This is the Yaphall Mill at Little Lake in Waseca, about 1896. And here's the Waseca County Courthouse, which you saw earlier, 1897. Designed by a fairly prominent Minneapolis architectural firm, Orton Geralman. Towns were planted on the rail lines to serve as shipping points for agricultural products and as supply and service centers. They were planted by railroad companies, individual proprietors, and combinations of the two. For most, the motive seems to have been purely economic. One variation, however, worth several Catholic rail town sites planted by Archbishop John Ireland.